Leadership is taking people on a journey where there's a vision, guidance, and purpose.
Good leaders lead with the heart as well as the head.
Leadership means doing the right thing for the right reason, no matter how difficult it might be.
You're listening to Leadership Unwrapped, a podcast where you will hear from people who are living leadership every day.
Hi, I'm Patricia. And I'm Niamh. And we just had a really interesting conversation with Jim Spillane, who both of us had, like so many of you, have probably read so much of his work and engaged with it in the past. So it was amazing to get the chance to speak to him about his new book with his colleague Rebecca, called Navigating the Principalship, Key Insights for New and Aspiring School Leaders. And it's just full of practical insights for those either in a position of leadership or thinking about it. And it was just a treat to get to chat to him about it and pick his brain a little bit more about those key bits that we pulled out.
Yeah, I think it's a really practical book. And yet at the same time, I know I mentioned to him, it distills some really complex ideas that are really helpful for you know, everyday leadership in schools. And it was just amazing to be able to hear the depth of wisdom that he had when he was talking about the different concepts and the different dilemmas that were in it. So it's rare that you get a book on leadership that's sort of like you really need to read it, but this is one of them. And just having the chance to speak to him also about things like distributive leadership, because he has led the field in that area, and just to hear his ideas about that and to be able to share them with our audience, just fantastic. Fantastic day, great conversation, Sonia. Thrilled that we got to do that.
Absolutely. You can tell how taken we are with the amount of post-it notes sticking out of Patricia's book there.
Typically me, but it's just a page turner. And you know, I wouldn't always say that books of the style are page turners, but this one really is. So yes, I'm saying go for it.
Brilliant. Enjoy.
Enjoy.
Jim Spillane is the Spencer T and Anne W. Ullin Professor in Learning and Organisational Change at the School of Education and Social Policy at Northwestern University. He is also Professor of Human Development and Social Policy, Professor of Learning Sciences, Professor by Courtesy of Management and Organisations, and Faculty Associate at Northwestern's Institute for Policy Research. Jim has published extensively on issues of education and policy, policy implementation, school reform, and school leadership. He also studies organisational leadership and change, conceptualising organisational leadership as a distributed practice. He has authored several books, one of which in particular we are going to talk about today. So, Jim, we're delighted to have you join us here this afternoon for us, this morning for you, to chat a little bit about your leadership journey, first of all, I suppose, and also your new book as well, which myself and Patricia have just recently read. So I know a lot of our listeners will know a little bit about you and your work, but I was wondering, just to get going, do you want to tell us a little bit about your journey into leadership and in leadership research?
Sure. Hello, Niamh and Patricia. It's lovely to be with you. Good morning from South Florida, where it's nice and warm, even if they're complaining a little bit about a cool spell. I'm a former primary school teacher. A classic case of a first generation Irish rural kid who goes to training college and spent 3 years at St. Pat's in Drumcondra, and then after a one-year master's in the US, went back and taught primary school at St. Mary's on the Hill in Knocknaheeny in Cork City. And that kind of the 1 year in the US, it was an exchange fellowship, kind of whet my appetite for academia and research. And the 3 years as a teacher teaching fifth class in Knocknaheeny with Sean O'Shea was my principal. Raised a lot of issues for me. Then I said, I would like to understand these better. So I applied to graduate school. And actually my PhD, my research was on policy implementation of policies designed to change teaching and learning, improve the quality of teaching and learning, And it was after finishing up my PhD, a 3-year postdoc, and I was an assistant professor at Northwestern when I became intrigued with the whole issue of leadership, in part because one of the big challenges when it comes to implementation, well, of course, the teacher is key when it comes to implementing new policies that are trying to improve teaching. But the other key actor was the principal and indeed leadership more broadly at the school and indeed the local level. So that got me very interested in leadership. But the thing that kind of intrigued me was not so much who the leaders were, but the practice of leadership itself. Mm-hmm. How could we think about leadership as practice? Just and in some ways, it paralleled all that work that was going on in the. This was the 90s, but it paralleled all that work that had been going on and trying to theorize teaching as a practice during the 70s and 80s. And I said, well, why aren't people trying to think about leadership as practice? So that's how I got into it. And it has led to a lot of work on distributed leadership or thinking about leadership as a distributed practice. And then, of course, I became intrigued by the work of the school principal. Some people kind of pushed back and said, but you said leadership is distributed. Why are you focusing on principals? I said, well, there's no reason why when you take a distributed framework to studying practice, you can't focus in on the work of the school principal. And in particular, I was intrigued by, you know, we often think about we can learn most from experts in the field, and I think there's some value to that. But very often, I think we can learn a lot also from novices because everything is new to them. Whereas for the expert, it's much of it becomes taken for granted. I mean, this is true for ourselves, right? As university teachers, we tacit knowledge a lot of the time. So I said, well, we more than likely could learn a lot from people who are coming into this role and the issues and the challenges that come up for them over their first 5-6 years on the job. So that's how that's a long way to how I got into this topic.
Yeah, and we're very glad you did. I think anyone who knows me and who knows my research will know that it was, of course, very influenced by your work, and it's framed a lot of my thinking around it as well. So there was an element of when I met you, Jim, the first time, kind of meeting a celebrity almost. You know, I had read so much of your work. It was like,
no doubt.
It was like I knew so much about your thoughts towards leadership, and yet had never met you. You know, that sort of way.
It must be really interesting, Jim, to see, you know, just how much that whole idea of shared and distributed leadership has grown, how it's changed. I mean, you must look back at this change in paradigm almost, or like you to see it. I see it in my own time as a teacher, how I was talking about this recently, about how that sort of authoritative way of thinking about leadership, it just doesn't fly, you know. So the whole paradigm of how we practice is changing so much. So it must be interesting to look at that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Patricia, you're right. In some respects, I was writing something recently and I was saying to myself, wow, I never thought when I started writing about this in the early 90s, that the idea would have such legs and spread so much, not only in the scholarly community, but in particular in the policy and indeed the practice community. I mean, it's an idea that has been picked up by lots of different governments, including in Ireland and the Department of Education. OECD has picked it up and several others. But it also has, I think, shaped research on leadership over the past 10, 15, 20 years. And, you know, there's part of me is very thankful for that, that, you know, very often as academics, we worry that our work has little or no influence. It sits on shelves and other academics' offices. But so it's kind of rewarding to see that. At the same time, there are times when I read some things or hear some people saying some things about leadership as distributed that I cringe and wonder whether I should ever have begun to theorize this. You know, some things that really get me concerned is when people say to me things like, well, everybody's a leader in an organization. And I said, well, not really. And you more than likely don't want it that way. So, but I think that's kind of inevitable when we work in this field and we put ideas out there. They morph or they get taken up in ways that we can no longer control. And I guess we should be thankful for the good. Somebody told me a couple of years ago that Howard Gardner at times has cringed at how multiple intelligence have been used.
Yeah.
So I guess, but yeah, it's surprising to me looking back, but it's also quite rewarding. And I guess correcting some misuses is not a bad thing to have to do.
Yeah.
I think the alternative would be much worse.
Yeah. I think that's an element of when, you know, when work becomes popular or picked up by lots of people. You know, I was listening to a video by, it was Brawn and Clark, you know, that had the thematic analysis paper in 2007, and they were talking about the misuses that they've come across with thematic analysis, and at times wondering if people had even read the paper, you know, that were citing it, you know, this way. I suppose, when you have so many people that are interested and engaging with content, it there's probably an inevitable aspect of it that it might be misinterpreted at times. And I think that idea of there being lots of different interpretations of distributed leadership has been particularly integral to my work, you know, in trying to find out, well, what is it actually meaning to people in practice, as well as us debating it kind of in theory and in academia, I suppose.
And I guess, Niamh, to that point, it also accepting that. Allows for more democratic notions about how we build knowledge and how we engage others in building knowledge. And I think one of the things in accepting that we should be okay with is to say to people when we hear things that we don't agree with that, I hear what you're saying, but that's not my understanding, and here is why. Mm-hmm. So that we engage in honest deliberations, I think. But accept the democratization of the knowledge production enterprise.
I think it's really interesting to look at, well, for me, I'm looking at what I'm calling like some concept cleanup. Sometimes this is the phrase I'm using for it, and I use it in relation to the bullying incivility research that we've done. So conflict almost becomes synonymous with bullying. If there's a piece of conflict, which is a good thing, actually, you know, because growth can come out of that. People can, you know, sort of misinterpret that as being, you know, something else. And that does damage to the bigger piece that you're trying to change around bullying in the workplace, for example. So that's why I think.
Yeah.
The space to go into the concept cleanup gives you the space to challenge the idea gently, but to open up the thinking so that the person grows a bit and says, like, is everybody a leader? Let's interrogate that a little bit and see, really, and see where people go with it, instead of just saying, well, it's impolite to say that because everybody must feel like they are. Do you know? So I quite enjoyed that kind of fencing with ideas once it's done in a growthful way. That's the piece, but... And you hope for that. No, that's the academia piece.
Yeah, I think I love that notion, Patricia, of concept cleanup or concept cleaning. And I do think it's important, and it can be done in a way that's generative. And it's also important, you know, because not only for research, but for practitioners and policymakers, because if the concepts are too fuzzy, they're kind of blunt instruments. Yeah. They're not very helpful to us, right? It's like, you know, any good carpenter will tell you that a blunt chisel or a saw that's not sharpened is results in not very good work.
Yeah.
So I think we enter the conversation in a way that, well, let's talk about that. Is it really this or not? And I think it helps us together to develop some taken as shared understandings of what these concepts are and are not, and appreciate the importance of that to the enterprises we're engaged in. Because otherwise, you know, we're just talking past one another. We're using the same label to talk about something entirely different. So I like concept cleanup. I'm going to steal that from you, Patricia.
I used it once or twice on things, and actually I just thought it gave me a space to say I got to come back to this in another paper. So I'll call in a paper for a piece of concept cleanup going and coming back to you, because I haven't finished my thinking on that one. But that isn't that the point, that growth is dynamic, or that knowledge is dynamic, right? And we don't always have it finished in that piece that we're doing. So we're moving forward kind of in the thinking. So, I mean, to me, distributive leadership is really robust, complex, difficult, challenging. You know, it's not just a sharing without thinking. It's requiring a whole set of skills here to be able to to optimize the skills of the people around you in your organization. And it's not for everyone either. In sometimes there's a growth piece to get people to that stage. So just making assumptions that we just do distributive leadership because it sounds like a good thing to do is a problem. We do need to go in there and say, what does this mean and how do we make it work so that the organization can move in the way that it needs to move? That's, I think it's an important way of thinking about it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. And I think, as you just said, decreeing that we're going to do distributed leadership in my school doesn't get one very far. It really necessitates thinking about the organization, what are the leadership tasks and functions we have to take responsibility for? Where does the expertise rely to take on those tasks? Maybe one person has all the expertise and maybe that is just fine. But more often than not, of course, we have to rely on more than one. But I think you're right. It's really thinking about the complexity of the work and getting away from the notion that, oh, leadership is distributed. Well, it is because you picked a framework to see it like that. The more interesting question is, how is it distributed?
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what we need to engage with as whether we're scholars or practitioners or policymakers. And I think that is what a lot of principals struggle with. You know, how do I distribute leadership in my school, especially if I'm a new principal coming in from outside, not knowing the lay of the land, not knowing... Yes, I get a sense of who my 10, 15 staff members are, but you get a very particular sense because they're putting their best faces forward to you. So it can take a while to figure out who are these people and what, and who has what expertise here, I think.
Yeah.
And there are lots of challenges involved in that I think we need to better understand. How do you bring people on board, for example? You know, we have, if you read the literature, it's often this either or. Either I am going to use a control strategy, I'm the principal, I'm going to tell you what to do, or I'm going to use a commitment strategy, I'm going to bring you all along, we're all in this together. And I think that, at least in the work we've been doing, that dichotomy doesn't hold up in practice.
Yeah.
Most organizations involve both.
Yeah.
And managing them is a key part of the work of leadership.
Yeah. There's a readiness piece, a maturity piece in the almost like the psyche of the group that's in the workplace I haven't looked at this, but this is where my head is around distributive leadership at the moment. There is a readiness piece or a ground work to bring people to a readiness piece that needs to be done culturally as well. And I think you've just alluded to that when you've said, like, you're coming in as a principal Or even, and you say it in your book, you know, if you've come from within or you're coming externally, there's different expectations that are coming with that, that are all, that also can become prisons a bit, that you have to kind of educate people around you that you're coming at this differently. And there's a bit of groundwork there before the readiness is there to do it. You know, interesting. I love that.
I mean, I think there are advantages to coming from inside, but there are also disadvantages, right? I mean, one of our principles in the book, I don't know whether we include this explicitly or not, but one of our colleagues said, oh, you've gone over to the dark side. So, you know, so there, and there's also, of course, the one of the assistant principals in the book, who became the principal at her school, found it hard to help the staff to appreciate that now she was in a different role and she could not do all the things that she used to do as assistant principal. So there are these trade-offs of whether you come from within or you come from outside that I think are important to acknowledge and to live with. I think one of the big messages from the book is we need to appreciate the messiness, of this work, and we need to acknowledge it to ourselves and live with it, rather than trying to simplify it in ways that it's you can't simplify it. And that's, I think, what the book tries to do.
Yeah, and I think it would just, when we're talking about kind of leadership styles, there just before we go on to the book, I think it's something that distributed leadership does, and your work in the area has done, is it's opened up a space where, you know, there's so many different leadership styles out there, you know, and they're like, everyone involved in leadership, whether you're a practitioner or you're an academic or a policymaker, you've heard of all these kind of buzzwords. But what it does, regardless of the style that you as a principal align with or the combination of styles you align with, it opened up a space for kind of conversations about the nuances in leadership. And the idea that it's not, when we talk about leadership, we have to talk about more than just the leader of the organization, that there's much more at play than that. So for me, I think that that's what's been amazing about your work in the area. But speaking of the book, anyway, we'll move on. So it's Navigating the Principalship, Key Insights for New and Aspiring School Leaders, for anyone who'd be interested in reading it. And we can put I linked information about it in the bio as well. But we'd love to have a little bit more of a chat with you about your thinking, I suppose, first of all, when you were planning the book, and then also obviously some of the key insights that have come out of the book as well. So one of the main things for whenever those of you who will read the book, when you do see it, it's framed within dilemmas. And for myself and Patricia, I think when we read it, that was the first thing that it was the way that it was framed that we were very intrigued by. Can you tell us a little bit kind of about your thoughts and decisions to frame it that way?
Yes. That is really one of the key messages that I hope people take from the book. We live in an age of what I call hyper problem solving. Everything's a problem. Everything lends itself to this kind of rational notion of problem solving. Mm-hmm. We crunch the numbers and we come up with two or three alternatives, and the data will suggest one over the other. And this notion of problem solving, by the way, there are times it works beautifully, right? But I think it, in many respects, by the way, there's a policy scholar, Joan, calls it decisionism. And Stephen Ball has another word for it that escapes me right now. I think maybe performativity. Yeah. But I think there are times when that works, and lots of international organizations, lots of governments have contributed to this. But the reality is that not every challenge that we encounter in schools, in classrooms, in the human improvement enterprise more broadly, lends itself to that. In other words, school principals, classroom teachers encounter challenges that are a very particular type of problem. And there are problems that they involve competing values. In other words, there are two alternatives or maybe three here that are roughly equally desirable. So choosing one over the other would likely just make things worse rather than better. Or there are two alternatives here that are equally undesirable. So therefore, this hyper-rational notion about problem solving is not going to work. We have to think about how can I work with these two more or less desirable outcomes or solutions, and how can I manage the tension between them? And I think I have to be very honest here. This came out of the data. We heard all these challenges, dilemmas. I don't think any principal mentioned dilemmas. They mentioned the word tensions. We're building on the work of a few other scholars, in particular, Magdalene Lampert, who wrote a classic piece about her teaching in the Harvard Ed Review in the 80s about the dilemmas she faced. And in doing so, critiquing this highly technical, rational notion of teaching. And of course, Larry Cuban, the historian, has written about dilemmas in educational administration and school leadership. So dilemmas are part and parcel. I mean, they're part and parcel of our everyday lives, by the way. If we just pause the moment, we come up with these tensions in our own everyday lives. And we know that despite what everybody tells us, if we got this app or that app, they're not going to solve the problem for us. We have to manage them. And I think one of the most important lessons that I would hope principals, aspiring principals, new principals take from the book is that it's important to recognize a dilemma and be able to distinguish it from a problem that might lend itself to choosing between two alternatives. Because, trying to apply this hyper-rational problem solving to a dilemma will likely just make it worse.
Yeah.
With dilemmas, I think we have to learn to cope with them, to manage them, and to balance the alternatives rather than choose one over the other.
It makes a lot of sense to me, because, and it is a really important counter discourse to the fix the problem. Because the thing about these dilemmas is that they're dynamic and existing, like they're not going away. Because human beings will always have dilemmas, and dilemmas are not going away. So it's like getting comfortable in the discomfort, being able to exist in there and to be able to navigate it. So, and to stop this almost, I think one of the things that I worry about for principal burnout is the sense that I must fix it because that's the job that I'm expected to do, and that's almost like the fallacy. That's the pain that we're causing for leaders, because you can't fix these things. But what you can do is make the environment safe enough for us to coexist with these dilemmas and continue to work well. If that's the way I'm looking at it. Yeah. So I love.
You're right on the mark, Patricia. I think that's exactly the way to look at it. And to go back to the earlier example I gave, I think most principals who reflect on and are honest about their work, they will tell you that there are times that they have to say to either a particular teacher or a particular parent or a particular staff member or a group of them, you know what? You're going to do it this way. And in other words, they're going to use a control strategy related to their positional authority. There are other times with the same group or with the entire group where they're saying, well, let's figure this out together. I'm not going to tell you what to do. So these two strategies, which too often in the literature we're saying take one or the other, these are strategies that have to coexist in the everyday work of a school or any organization, and helping principals, helping leaders, education leaders broadly to acknowledge and live with that, I think, would help reduce the stress that too often I think we create for them. You have to choose one or the other. You have to fix this problem.
And I think one of the pieces that can be very difficult for leaders at the moment is the expectation that everything has to be negotiated and agreed in a very democratic way. And you can't always do that. So you have to push down that I want to keep everybody happy piece of you and keep the, but I must do what's right for the organization and do my best to do the best decision here. But we're setting such high standards for our leaders to be in this very democratic negotiated space that it's almost become unacceptable to exercise the legitimate authority that sometimes you have to in order to.
You have to.
You can't get 60 people to agree on something at the same time if you have huge staff. So we're not having enough conversation about that dilemma. That's so I'm thrilled that your book is bringing up that dilemma. That's really my last sentence on that one.
Yeah, I know. I think you're right. I think it also, you know, from an efficiency perspective, you can't spend days and weeks deliberating on every decision. And you have to ask yourself, what are the trade-offs for the most important decisions, I think. I think we also have to acknowledge that, you know, schools are public organizations. They reside in this pluralistic environment where they serve many stakeholders. Parents, students, community members, teachers, and these groups don't always agree. And even within any one stakeholder group, parents don't always agree about what should be going on. So I think we need to appreciate the challenges that arrive in that do not lend themselves to one solution or another, that actually have to be managed across time. And I think there are lots of challenges for principals in that I think if they appreciate it from the outside, or certainly as they take on the job, that these things won't be fixed, it would make their lives, I think, considerably easier. And there are coping strategies for dealing with these dilemmas that some of them we tried to outline in the book. They're not perfect fixes, far from it, because often they raise up other dilemmas. So, for example, we talk about being transparent, but there are limits to transparency. You know, you have a staff member where there's an issue, but legally you can't be upfront about everything that's going on for legal reasons. Yeah. So transparency has limitations. So I think, you know, again, this is part of the hyper rational problem solving environment we live in, right? We have to learn to accept the coping strategies as that. They're not perfect fixes. They help us manage the tension, manage the dilemma across time, but it's not going away and you have to live with the discomfort around that.
Yeah. I'm going in another direction as well with this, Jim, which is about the follower piece in all of this as well, right? So, and I think that leadership, because of the change, and we talked about this a little bit, that the paradigm change in understanding leadership and this more negotiated sort of space around leadership, you know, it's much easier to criticize leaders now, and leaders are held to even higher and higher and higher expectations of being perfect. And they get pulled down very often because they haven't done something that one or two people aren't happy with. And that creates a real challenge for leaders. But the piece that's missing is the conversation with the followers about what are they like as followers and what is that impact having for the leader. Because it's very easy to give out about the leader, but it's not so easy to look at myself and say, am I gossiping a lot there? I'm pulling that person down, even though they're doing their best. We're not doing that conversation either. And that's another part of the dynamic of the culture of that sort of dilemmas and distribution in leadership. That's part of the. So I'm interested in going down that route in the next year or two.
I think actually, Patricia, that would be a great study to think about what are the responsibilities, what are our responsibilities in the followership role? And of course, we all move in, I mean, principals move in and out of being leader follower. But I think that would be a great line of inquiry that I don't think there's a lot written on. Yeah. The other thing, though, to your point, I just was, there was a National Academy panel titled, Who Will Teach who will lead a couple of weeks ago in Washington, because there's a huge, to your point, there's a huge, who would want to take on this job where we expect our leaders, our principals, to be everything? And I think part of this, at least in the US, came out of COVID, but I think it preceded that. I mean, increasingly, we expect our school principals not only to have responsibility for kids' academic development, but to take on a whole other host of issues having to do with kids' welfare, family welfare. And it's almost like we're setting them up for failure, because there's no way they can address all of these issues. And how do they, what things fall through the cracks, what things, but I think it's a huge challenge for the field.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Yeah, I think it's an area that I think there's so much change happening in just the assumptions of our understandings, like at that deeper level, and that they're playing out then. Yeah. And I think distributive leadership is right at the nexus of that, because we're trying to change the way that we're thinking about our own agency in our work as followers, as well as leaders. But all this deeper assumption stuff is changing too. I'm just very interested in that, I had a few conversations with the students on our programs about what is the kind of talk that you're doing about your leader, you know, and that, and you want to be that leader in the future, but what is the kind of talk you're doing right now? Because what's good for the goose is good for the gander, as we say down in Kerry.
That's right.
So there's a bit of that going on as well, you know. I just find that fascinating.
And of course, there's a tension for the leader here too. I mean, the volume of work that they have to take on kind of pushes them to engage others. But at the same time, they're worried, given Patricia, the culture that you just described, they're worried that, well, if something goes wrong, it's going to fall on me, right?
Yeah.
So therefore, even though they engage others in, through delegation or distribution of tasks, there's this tendency, I think, to be always looking over their shoulders to make sure that it's being done right. And of course, as we all know, if somebody gives me something to do and they're constantly looking over my shoulder, I'm going to turn around and say, you know what? Do it yourself. Yes. You're wasting my time. I think that's another tension in all of this.
So I was just going to say it's a huge challenge for things like trying to share leadership, for trying to build leadership capacity within the organization. But I think it's probably the crux of where... you know, a lot of the stress and burnout and people not going for leadership positions, which is a huge issue in Ireland at the moment. I think it seems to be similar from what you've said there as well, Jim, but that overwhelming sense of responsibility and accountability on leaders. And then the other issue with it, which you kind of alluded to, is what's falling through the cracks then because of that. So I know I was speaking to a school leader as part of my research, and they said, you won't get fired for teaching and learning, or you won't get fired for curriculum, but you could for, you know, X, Y, or Z of those kind of accountability pieces based on the inspections and things like that. So there's lots of different tensions, I guess, or dilemmas that are being held in that place of the responsibility and accountability piece.
Yeah. I thought it was really interesting in the book because you called it the responsibility dilemma, and you talked about the sheer volume of the principal's responsibilities is such that they can't tackle them single-handedly themselves. But ultimately, being responsible makes it really difficult to share the load at the same time, because the buck is going to stop with you and it's your neck on the chopping block. So, and that's the bit where I was going about the trust piece. Yeah,
this was one of the biggest shocks. Most principals... in the study had been in some sort of school leadership role before they took the principalship. A lot of them were assistant principals, but others were curriculum directors or roles like that. So much of the work, for most, they were familiar with, they expected it. But the biggest shock they got in that first 3 months in the job was this sense of ultimately being responsible. The buck stops with me. So, you know, everybody, you know, I remember vividly an assistant principal saying to us, before I took this job, as when I was the assistant principal, I would go home on a Friday night and I could shut off until Monday. but now that cannot happen. And this sense of being ultimately responsibility pervaded their first year and actually into subsequent years on the job, that the buck would always stop with them, no matter what. At the end of the day, if something went badly wrong, it would be their responsibility. And delegation helped them manage that dilemma a little bit, but it never, it didn't fix it, to use this language.
Yeah.
It was always there.
Yeah.
I think a real, real challenge for anybody assuming this job. Now, does it have to be that way? I think these are questions we should ask ourselves. I mean, certainly, organizationally and policy-wise, we have contributed to this in terms of, you know, the metrics we hold the principal accountable and stuff like that. But I think one thing that we might do as a field is to ask ourselves, well, by the way, I'm really taken by this recent efforts to use imagination as a research method. And I can't think of the British sociologist who has a book on this that's really powerful. But several scholars in the US have also been asking, how can we use them? So could we imagine leadership in the school? I mean, a distributed framework tries to do this in part, but could we imagine leadership for schools, school organizations being structured differently, so that the principal does not end up with this sense of ultimate responsibility? Because I think it's important to remember that a lot of these dilemmas arise from the structures, structures of the education system, but also the societal structures in which principals work. I mean, these dilemmas that we document in the book are especially pronounced in schools that serve students who, by virtue of societal structures, are often disenfranchised by the system. And I think it's important that we keep that in mind.
Yeah, yeah. And the other piece that comes out from the work is that that responsibility dilemma deepens and deepens, and there's a dynamic of deepening. It never seems to lessen, and the more that you got deeper into the concept, that was deepening in them, and that responsibility and obligation, that I certainly took away from it. I was saying the more they're doing it, the more committed, the deepening. So they're quite amazing people, actually. They don't run for the hills and say it's too much.
No.
They actually just continue to lean in, to use Sheryl Sandberg's phrase, into that responsibility piece. I thought that was really interesting.
I think I think Patricia, and I think it's very, the sense of social obligation, social responsibility that motivates so many people to take this job is really at the core of the sense of being ultimately responsible. I mean, a lot of these principals talk about that the students in the schools where they work need somebody like them in a leadership position.
Yeah.
That I'm. This is me giving back to my community, my people. I think that is very much at the core of having this sense. And of course, as you say, it weaves into all these other dilemmas. I mean, the volume of work, the diversity of work that I feel I have to do. It's hard to manage that if you feel you're ultimately responsible for all of it. So I think that's key. And of course, it also goes to what I call the ultimate dilemma, which is this constant effort across their first 5 or 6 years on the job, at least, to balance work life and home life, to balance the professional and the personal. Mm-hmm. And they talk about this, but they're still talking about it in year 4 and 5, not having fixed it, because they can't fix it. And this comes, I think, to issues of mental health, issues of physical well-being. I mean, you have some really powerful accounts of a principal saying, I woke up at 2 a.m. in the morning wondering about, worrying about How am I going to deal with this? Making notes to myself. You know, that's not tenable. I don't think as a field we can feel good about that. And especially now that we're talking about well-being so much, I think we need to address these issues of well-being. Mm. And again, it calls for thinking about perhaps in new radical ways about how do we structure this work.
I like the idea of reimagining, actually. I like what you're saying about sort of thinking about that as a way of researching and thinking, because I do think we need to reimagine the role in a more balanced and healthier way. And then to pull back to say, so what do we need to do to get there? I saw a tweet just recently from a school leader who has received school leaders in Ireland have received a policy kind of imprimatur this week, Christmas week, this week, and they're trying to do everything. And it came up on Twitter, and I was saying, timing really bad here for the well-being of principals to get something this big. Systemically, we have a responsibility here too about saying, this isn't okay. So... So we need to reimagine and have that conversation at all the tiers of what is and isn't acceptable in terms of the timing even of work that we expect of these school leaders.
Yeah,
that was really interesting, you know.
And I think the some of it involves, as your example just captures beautifully, Patricia, simple things like timing. Was there any reason why that should have happened Christmas week versus... a month before or a month afterwards. But I think also we have to think that a lot of these issues likely go beyond the education sector to child policy, child well-being, family policy more broadly. That kind of reimagining will involve some cross-sectoral work, I think, that is likely critical because, I don't know for sure about Ireland, but I know in the US, increasingly our schools are called upon to take on more than educating children, they're to take on a whole slew of social policy issues, often to do with budget tightening and the likes, and it falls to the school by default rather than by design. And of course, it falls to the principal.
Similar. And it's definitely having a huge impact on the parameters of the role of what is the function of the school, and how a principal navigates that. But it also intersects for me with what's happening in the world of work and organizational psychology, which we don't talk a lot about in the school. We don't talk about the school as a workplace as much as we need to, but the increasing pace of work and, you know, so school is care work as well as education. There's something really special happening in within those four walls. But the increasing pace and dynamic of having to, you know, more and more and more work, more and more done, faster, quick responses, policy coming to you. COVID changed the timing of when the department can send you imprimaturs. You can get them late on a Friday. You can get them on a Sunday. And a principal has to be responsive and ready to go on Monday. We need to have conversations even about that, about protecting the psychological space of the workplace so that the care work can continue. And the education work can continue. Those are also very important.
I think you're right on. I mean, I think this is why I think early on I mentioned that I like to think about teaching as a part of the human improvement enterprise, because that's what it fundamentally is. And it shares a lot of similarities with other professions like psychotherapy, social work, et cetera. And the nature of that work is such that a lot of what we talked about today is a function of the very nature of the work. But I think you're very right. We don't discuss this. We don't study it in great depth. Mm. And in part, I think it may have something to do with the fact that teaching tends to be a very much a solo practice. Yeah. The teacher closes the door, does the work, right?
Yeah.
But we know that that model needs to change. It is changing in some places, but I think our understanding of all the important work that happens between classrooms, that happens before school, after school, breaks and stuff like that, and the need for us as a school staff to work on this as a collective rather than individuals, I don't think we understand that as well as we should, and that we need to.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and I think, as you say, those of us in academia researching these types of things, and people in policy and in third level, do have an obligation and a responsibility to be asking these questions as well. Because, as you say, Jim, can we feel good about ourselves knowing that there's the increase in stress, increase in burnout, people not wanting to go for the jobs of school leaders? But something I think that's within the system as it is now, from your book with Rebecca, that was a very practical snippet for leaders to take away when thinking about types of things that they can share within the school, because I know that's ultimately an element of sustainability as well, isn't it? From the leader's perspective, being able to share things out, was that idea what's non-negotiable for the leader and what can be shared, and that as kind of a framework for leaders navigating that space, which I thought was really interesting and really practical takeaway for people in that position.
Yeah, I think it goes back in part to our earlier conversation about, you know, democratic yeah. institutions, democratic organizations, and maybe our overplay of everything has to be a democratic decision, when in fact lots of things don't need to be. And if everything is, then the quality of the deliberation for any one thing will not be very good. So what are those things that we really feel we need to have deliberation about? But I think also, Niamh, to your point, I think it is, you know, part of the reason people take on leadership positions is that they do have powerful visions about how things might be. They do have a sense of, you know, I think I can do this better. I think I can create a school where kids are really engaged and where kids will do wonderful things. So I think we need to help leaders when they have that kind of powerful vision to say, okay, this is your vision. What part of it is not negotiable? What part of it are you not prepared to give up? But then what parts of it is there some fluidity around that you are prepared to allow others to help you craft, construct? What parts maybe are you prepared to give on a bit? So I think helping principals to understand what's really, really at the core of their decision to be in this position. Because if they lose that, they're going to give up, or they're not going to be very good principals, right? But at the same time, helping them understand that you are going to give up on some things. And you more than likely, there are some things in your vision that are likely wrong or that cannot work in this. So having that sense of, here is what's central to who I am. Here are things that, you know, I can listen, I can learn, I can change my mind on these things, and I will still be the leader. I think part of the problem, and this again goes to these unrealistic ideas we have about leadership, is you figured it out, you're always right, and if you're wrong, or if you change your mind, there's something, you're no longer a good leader. Yeah. I think we have to get away from those myths because they are myths. You know, I think really good, and this is part of transparency, right? A really good leader will say to their staff, you know, I was wrong about this, and here is why. They're being transparent. They're explaining. And we're going to, I've heard what you're saying. We're going to try it a different way.
Yeah, I
think that's powerful. I think you'll move an organization away more like that than if you're saying, well, no, it's my way or the highway. And this openness to learning, but at the same time, I think you do have to have a set of principles a set of ideas that and anybody who takes this job, right? Anybody who takes this job, I think, has those ideas. They're doing it for a reason. They're doing it for that sense of social responsibility. They're doing it because they believe that, you know, the kids in the school can really succeed and do great things. And I have a set of ideas about how we might do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's really important. I remember being in a meeting with a colleague, a senior colleague, when quite early in my journey, and I remember him saying, "I'm going to say this now, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to defend it next week." You know, and he put out the idea. Yes. And what you were doing was you were saying, "Okay, I'm signing up to that, but we're not 100% certain if that's the right way to go." Yeah. He sort of had the proviso piece, and I loved it because it was dynamic and it wasn't stuck. And once or twice you had to roll back and say, okay, that didn't go the way I was expecting. But most of the time you didn't. But there was a liberation in it. There was a freedom in it. And he was, what he was doing that I know now was releasing himself from the expectations of others that he had to be right and that he couldn't fail. And it was really subtle. But I thought, wow, that's a good leadership technique to put in the back pocket about not having to be.
And he was modeling.
He was modeling.
No, it's powerful. Powerful. I do this in teaching all the time. I mean, I say to my students, especially graduate students, but even undergrads, I say, you know, these are things that I've learned to do and read. I've changed over the years, but sometimes they don't work. Let me know.
Yeah.
And even during a quarter, I'll say things like, "I'm not sure that worked last week. What did you think? Should we do it? Should we do a different type of activity next week?" So I think that's the sort of. And at the same time, I do have certain things that I'm not prepared to give up on teaching. I'm not going to go in and lecture for 90 minutes to you. No matter what you tell me, I'm not going to do that. Right?
Yeah.
But I do think modeling and saying, you know, here are my expectations, and one of them is not that I know how to do this perfectly, and you should just believe that. So,
there's that vulnerability piece to that as well, isn't there? But like when you translate that into schools and school leaders, the vision that school leaders have for their organization, I think it's such an interesting thing to think about, because it's very hard. I think it's a very challenging thing to find the balance of, right, these are the things that I really want and that I won't disagree, like I won't change my mind about, that I know are integral to who I am and what I want for this school, while also ensuring that that aspects of what you're doing can be challenged. There can be discussion. There's that room for flexibility, for change and improvement, but then retaining, you know, what it is that you want to focus on. So I think it's a really interesting space to think about. And I think what you said there, Jim, about having core values is very, good term to use, because I think you can have core values without having concrete aspects of what, you know, what you want this, exactly what you want the school to be, that can't be challenged. So I think that's an important way of thinking about it, but I do think it's challenging.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, Neil. I think the other part to what you just said is that, you know, most of the principals in the book, especially those who came from outside their schools, took time to figure out what was going on here. And in other words, yes, they had a set of principles. Yes, they had a set of reasons why I'm doing this. But they didn't just say, "Well, here we go." They listened. They attended grade level meetings. They talked to teachers. They talked to parents. They talked to kids. They got a sense of what's happening. And I think that listening and learning over the first 6-7 months also help shape where they were taking the school. So I think that's the other little piece I would add to this. They engaged in some serious diagnostic work before they started to redesign things in the organization, yeah. before they started to change things up. So that it, and I mean, I think part of that listening is, it goes to Patricia's point about the example of this leader modeling for her. They were modeling something also. They're saying, I'm here to, I'm going to listen to you. I want to learn. But they were also trying to figure out what's really going on here. And even in fairness, some principals who came from inside, some teachers who came from inside to be the principal did that also, because they recognized that what they knew from the perspective of being a classroom teacher was likely quite different from what they were going to, what they were going to learn from being the principal. But it's still very challenging, because I think, I bet you a lot of parents, a lot of community members don't see this fuzziness, don't see that. They expect, a strong principal is somebody who knows what to do and will do it regardless. But I think we also need to help parents and the public to appreciate that well-run organizations are run by people who listen, who learn. Who have a certain humility and ability to empathize, I think.
The other thing that I was very struck with, maybe it's from my own journey in leadership, that it's my own challenge too, is about establishing the boundary. That, you know, because what I think one principal was in, well, a few, but in particular was talking about, you know, creating the boundary, because wanting to be so accessible to everybody, but knowing that you can't do the good work. The, you know, you can do the interrupt-driven work if you're accessible to everyone. But to be able to do the deep thinking work, you needed to create boundary and not be as available. And that's a dilemma that you, so because as teachers, we work in relationship, everything's about relationship. And you sort of have to find a way to bring that piece down and bring up the other, the strategic. That was a really interesting dilemma piece for me. I liked that. A lot of space for that.
And it was a key lesson in their first year. A lot of them learned to draw boundaries. They began with these notions that it could be everything, in part because stakeholders were, you know, I mean, there was one principal, they wanted, the community leaders wanted her to be a key leader in an issue with lead in the community. Another Hispanic principal, the community organizers wanted him to really lead in moving the community, but they all had to begin to draw boundaries by prioritizing what was most important, creating time that you were not accessible. The door was closed where you could work on stuff that was important. And it really was almost like that first year. And one of my former students, who now works at the RAND Corporation, Andrea Prada, has a paper on this. It was almost like they were reimagining in that first year, are rediscovering what this job was about. And part of it, Patricia, was about drawing certain boundaries around the job. And again, this goes to the volume and task, the sheer volume of the work and the sheer diversity of the work. And it's very public nature.
And that piece about learning in the job, you know, so that you want to do it and then you're in it and you're learning in that, actually the vision you came with, where you're going to keep everybody happy and be available to everybody. Lovely ideal, but there are bigger imperatives and you got to figure out new ways of doing it, which I thought was really interesting. And the other piece for me, because, and it's a conversation I know I've had with a couple of colleagues that I admire very much in my own workplace, when we're talking about what we do as teacher educators, they always say it's about the child in the classroom. Okay, we're in the university and we're training teachers and it's wonderful, but I see my job, the focus of my job is the child in the classroom. And in the book, that you talk about centering the children, and the leaders talk about centering the children. That's their North Star. That's their compass. That's the phrase I put on it from what I was reading in the work. I got really excited when I saw that, because that resonated with me about why we do what we do, no matter where we're positioned in our education system as leaders. It sort of kept centering them honest and focused. Yeah. It was really good.
Centering on children. It was a strategy that they used. Yeah. You know, when they were being pulled in all these different directions, center on the child. And I think that also helped them when they were dealing with this dilemma between the academically tested child versus the developmentally unabridged child. You know, the metrics that they were held accountable for, and this is very much an American thing, but were how well the kids were doing in English and mathematics and attendance, right? But these principals, even when they were doing great on those, said, but our notions of child development are much broader than that. We want children who do science, do art, are physically, are excited or happy. And I think by centering on the child, by centering on children, that helped them to manage that dilemma. It never went away. They couldn't ignore the tests, right? Because if they did bad on these metrics, they'd lose their jobs in 4 years, right? Yeah. So, but here was a way to manage it. It's all about the child. How can I balance these competing values? And by centering on the child, I think. Yeah. And that was very, very powerful. The same, I think, in dealing with managing parents who had different ideas, always center on the child.
I loved it. I thought it was just a bringing us back to the core of why we do leadership and why we teach and what the function of what we're trying to do is, that whole, as you say, the human improvement piece. But sometimes you do need a compass. You do need need something that sort of points north for you. And I thought it was a really good anchor that just organically came from these leaders. I thought it was really cool. Loved it.
Yep. No. I think it's very, very important. This whole issue, by the way, of our notions, our visions for child development, I think are very, very important. And it kind of surprises me that we're rediscovering again the need for holistic child development. I mean, how do we lose it? I mean, why did it take a pandemic to bring us back to down to reality, if you will? So,
I hope you don't start shouting at me or figuratively throwing stones at me through Zoom. I'm just conscious of time and wondering if we should move on to the quick fire questions. I know I'm cutting this conversation about 10 hours too short, but
I won't throw a stone at you on through Zoom. If I can say, maybe Jim, we could talk again. Could we do a Mark II of this?
Of course, yeah.
Again, maybe, because I've loved it so much. So it's only
I'd love to do that. That'd be great. Really, I'm happy to do that.
Lovely, brilliant. Okay, so until then, the first thing is a leader who inspires you and why, Jim?
So, you know, I thought about this and I have to go to an Irish context. I have to mention three names and they're political leaders, but the late Gary Fitzgerald, as I was growing up as a teenager, gay in rural Ireland, and here was a leader who imagined a different Ireland that, of course, he died before it was fully realized, but he was ahead of his time. And for me, that was, powerful. He was somebody who, but he was followed by two very powerful, and now I'm crossing the whole political spectrum, so nobody can be upset with me. two other very powerful people for me, Mary Robinson.
Absolutely.
And Mary McAleese. I mean, Mary McAleese is very personal use of her own life and her own family around the gay marriage, I think, was just, I cried when I listened to that speech. So here are three Irish political leaders who I think were visionaries, who I think helped lead a new Irish society that I'm so proud of, that I wish I had grown up in, but it took a while. And I think that has made Ireland a beacon to the rest of the world on lots of social issues. So that's my answer. I had to think about it a bit, but I kept coming back to these three very powerful, very, very powerful leaders.
Yeah. I'm nodding, nodding, nodding. You can see it on the Zoom, so the listeners can't see it, but I'm resonating really well, because for my time, coming up through that time, very much that visionary open-mindedness, you know, that open, there was an open, fresh thinking piece that Gareth Fitzgerald brought that was like a breath that went through. So I certainly can, and certainly followed by two world-class presidents who just set a tone of humanity across the globe that I'm very proud to be Irish to watch them do what they did. Yeah. So on the same page as you on that.
It was moving. It was very moving, very moving. Yeah.
Yeah. So looking back on your leadership research journey and your career journey, or just in that space, is there anything you do differently? The big question.
No, it is a great question. I think I'd love to, as a researcher, as a scholar, and I'm not sure I'll do it at this stage, to look at education leadership from the perspective of children, and in particular from the perspective of elementary and high school children. Mm-hmm. This is an omission. There is a little bit of work. A British scholar who's escaping me. She spent her career at Cambridge. She died far too young. Did a little bit of work on this, but I think it would be really powerful to understand leadership. I mean, kids are powerful leaders. The peer influence they have. Mm. So thinking of education, I would love to, maybe my... when I come back in the next life, really explore this terrain from the perspective of children.
I think we'd learn something really interesting. I do.
Powerful.
Yeah.
Powerful.
I know as a mom now listening to children talking about how they experience teachers. I'm listening to teenagers, how they experience teachers and school leaders. You know, you're kind of going, okay. You know, because we think we're doing it one way, but the way they're experiencing it's really interesting to just listen. So I like that idea. Yeah. I do.
And we should remember that, you know, in the civil rights movement, students were in the US, students were key leaders in that. So it's easy to forget these things. Sorry, Niamh.
No, you're okay. I was just going to say that, like, there's a huge part of sharing leadership that comprises student voice as well, and student leadership. And I know I kind of thought about it a good bit when I was starting off my PhD, and there was an element of, I was thinking that I think we need to work out some of the nuances within the Irish context with regard to shared leadership among staff, and then kind of have a look at students as well. But it would be a hugely powerful area, definitely. And then the last question we have for you, Jim, is one piece of leadership advice that you would give someone starting out on their leadership journey. And I have to laugh, when I emailed Jim this, I put in brackets afterwards, I don't know how you're going to summarize this quickly, because your whole book is full of practical insights for people to take away.
So, I think read the book is the answer, which anyway, no, Jim, go on. Give us an answer.
Just to go back to the last question on students, one of the most powerful experiences I had was last March, working with the NCCA, and we spent a day with the Beacons Project with children about the new primary school framework and what they wanted. Mm-hmm. It was one of the most powerful experiences I've had in a long, long time. My advice is, read the book, Patricia. Great advice. I think my simple bit of advice is practice humility and listen and learn from others. Regardless of where they are in the enterprise that you're part of. I think we don't listen enough. If we listen, we don't hear. The listening is performative. I think really listening, hearing, and learning from others, I think would be one of my key pieces of advice. But there's lots more in the book, so read the book.
Yeah, read the book. Read the book. I'm telling everybody, read the book. Yeah. Absolutely. Jim, it's been an absolute treat. You know, they say, be careful if you want to meet your idols because you could get disappointed. Well, just having done it, I have to tell you, you lived up and surpassed my expectations. I'm absolutely thrilled to have had this conversation. And I do
Thank
want
you,
to continue.
Patricia.
I'd love to do another if you're up for talking to us again, because there's lots more to chat about. There's lots of ideas happening here.
I'm happy to do that. It was lovely to talk to you both. And
yeah.
Take care.
And we'd love to see you again.
I'd love that. I'd love
Brilliant.
That.
Brilliant. Okay. Thanks
and
so
I'll
much.
See Take you care. In the Southern
Bye-bye.
Hemisphere, Jim, next time.
Yes, next week. 2 weeks.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's
bye-bye.
It. Thanks so much.
I better get packing. Bye-bye.